It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
Good morning. For those of you who are new or don't know me, my name is Henry Hugg, and I'm a worship associate. And you're about to witness a first in this church, at least with Davidson. This is the first time that he will share, or I will share with him, the homily. He has shared the homily with other ministers, with intern ministers, and the director of religious education, but never with a lay member of the church. All this started a couple of months ago when a group of us, worship associates who are supposed to write and read a 4 or 5 minute contribution to the service, and I asked, I'd like to do that, but it has to be done on the last Sunday of October, because that is Dia de los Muertos. And I had entitled my talk, it would be about 4 minutes, Thanatology. The first reaction by Davidson was, no, we cannot have that title. It'll send people running for the dictionary. And they may not find it if they don't know how to spell it. So he suggested another name, and it's the title of this book, On Death and Dying. And just to give you some background for those of you who don't know it, I'm retired now, but for over 30 years I trained and practiced as a surgeon. So dealing with cancer patients, it's easy to see how I have dealt with death on an almost daily basis. And I would like to cover 3 subjects. The first one is the death of the supreme thanatologist, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who did write this book. She died on August 24th. The second is the case of Terry Schiavo, the Florida woman who is in persistent vegetative state. And finally, the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, or Assisted Suicide Act. Kubler-Ross was born in Zurich, Switzerland, where she went to medical school and then came to this country in 1957 to train as a psychiatrist. She was appalled at the way that hospitals handled death. She became interested in studying death when she saw her mother go through a long and painful final illness that lasted 2 years. And she went to England to view firsthand how they comforted dying patients. 35 years ago, in 1969, she wrote the first of 13 books. It became an instant classic entitled On Death and Dying. 4 years later, I bought the book, and it was then in its 10th printing. I haven't been able to find out how many more printings since then. In the book, she described the 5 stages that people go through when they're given a fatal diagnosis and prognosis. The first one is denial. The doctor must be wrong. I'm going to get a second opinion. I'm not hurting anywhere. When the second and sometimes third and fourth opinion confirms the original one, the patient moves on to the second stage. It's anger. Why me? What have I done to deserve this? The third stage is bargaining. Dear Lord, if you spare me, I will do good works for you. Fourth stage is depression. When the patient cannot sleep, loses appetite, and shows most or all of the symptoms of clinical depression. The fifth and final stage is acceptance, where the patient is at peace with himself and with the world. Not all patients go through all 5 stages. Some remain in early stages. Others may retrogress before moving forward. Now, did you know that it is possible to go through all 5 stages in 5 minutes? Yes, and I bet some of you have. Let me give you this scenario. We're not dealing with a fatal diagnosis, just something that'll cost you some money. You're driving along on a road, 55 miles an hour. A few cars are there, and they're also driving about the same speed. The only problem, this is a 35 mile an hour zone. And you hear a siren. The first is denial. No, they can't be after me. Look at all of those other. Even that car over there is going a little faster than I am. When the trooper plants itself behind your car, and then you realize that, yes, it is you, it's anger. Why me? Why not that other guy who's speeding even faster than I am? Then comes bargaining. Oh, come on, officer. There weren't that many cars on the road. It's a clear day. The pavement is dry. It doesn't work. I learned early on that you don't argue with your teacher, you don't argue with a judge, you don't argue with a referee, and you don't argue with a patroller. So after he is writing your ticket, you go into depression. This is going to cost me $100. I was going to buy something nice for my spouse or for myself, and now I can't do it. And finally, acceptance. Well, he's written me a ticket. I'll just have to write a check, and I'll be more careful next time. All in less than 5 minutes. Now, Dr. Kubler-Ross repeated her mother's experience when she suffered the first of several strokes 2 years before her death that left her paralyzed, in pain, unable to care for herself, and dependent on others. In spite of her own experience and that of her mother, to the end, she remained adamantly opposed to euthanasia or assisted suicide. The second subject that I would like to cover is that of Terry Schiavo, the Florida woman who is in persistent vegetative state and has been there for 14 years. She originally suffered a cardiac arrest because of an electrolyte imbalance secondary to bulimia. She was resuscitated, but not before she suffered extensive brain damage. Patients in persistent vegetative state differ from those in coma in that they do not appear to be asleep. I have seen a few of those in my practice. Their eyes are open, they grimace, which some relatives interpret that as smiling, and the movement of the eyes as they're following what I'm saying. Of course, if you watch from a distance with nobody in the room, they're doing the same thing. Her husband petitioned the court to have her feeding tube removed and let her die based on the fact that in life she had frequently voiced that she did not want to live forever in such a condition. Terry's parents and sister hang to the futile belief that with some unconventional treatment she may recover someday and petitioned the Florida governor to have the tube reinserted. And I use this word cautiously. The busybody governor, knowing that he didn't have the authority to order the reinsertion of the tube, asked, and again this word, the meddlesome legislature to pass a law that would allow him to give the order. In less than 24 hours, the two chambers of the legislature hastily gave the governor the authority to have the tube reinserted. Michael Schiavo, the husband, challenged the law, and Judge Douglas Baird agreed with him, ruling that the law was probably unconstitutional because it violated the separation of powers. An appellate court concurred with a case, and it went to the Florida Supreme Court. A few weeks ago, the Supreme Court judges, two of them appointed by Governor Bush, unanimously declared that the law was unconstitutional because it reduced the courts to being a mere consulting body if the legislator could overrule a decision of the courts by passing a new law. The lesson to be learned from this ordeal is that if you don't have a living will, you should not walk, you should run. We're making it easy for you. In the gallery is Dacine Willman with the appropriate forms that you can fill out. They don't have to be notarized. You designate someone who will follow your wishes, and you just have it witnessed. Don't be in the position of Terry Schiavo. Incidentally, in a living will, it could also be that you want to be kept alive as long as possible. Just make sure that the person that you designate will follow your orders. The correct name of the so-called living will now is a directive to physicians and surrogates. The third and last subject I would like to cover is the Oregon Right to Die Law. In 1994, that was 10 years ago, the Oregon legislature passed a law that allowed a physician to prescribe a large amount of barbiturates to terminal patients who were expected to live less than 6 months. Then Governor Kitzhaber, a physician himself, signed it into law. This law had multiple safeguards to prohibit abuse. Among them, the patient had to be a resident of Oregon for at least 6 months to prevent an influx of patients from other states. The person had to have had a patient-doctor relation with an Oregon physician for at least 6 months. Two other physicians had to concur that the patient was indeed terminal with a life expectancy of less than 6 months and was capable of making rational decisions. Only then could the physician prescribe a large dose of barbiturates, enough to be fatal if ingested, and the patient is then given instructions on how to proceed. Not having practiced in Oregon, although I do have a license to practice in that state, I have read that some patients chose not to take the fatal dose before dying, but died with the peace of mind that it was available if needed. Within weeks of the governor signing the law, attorneys from the National Right to Life petitioned the United States District Court Judge Michael Hogan to review the case and declare it unconstitutional. The state of Oregon appealed the decision to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and ordered the reversal of Judge Hogan's decision. Judge Hogan, not satisfied, made an end run around the reversal by allowing the National Right to Life to refile the lawsuit under different grounds. In 1995, Hogan once again ruled the law unconstitutional because it violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Again, the appellate court rebuked the rather weak argument made by Judge Hogan, and the United States Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal. In November of 1995, Oregon voters resoundingly reaffirmed the country's only assisted suicide law. A few weeks later, the persistent Judge Hogan complied with the appellate court by dismissing the National Right to Life lawsuit, but once again left the door open a crack by allowing once more to consider an amendment of the lawsuit and start the process anew. Let me digress here for a moment. When I was in practice in Michigan, a patient of mine with a circuit court judge who told me that the judges always rule with an eye on what a court of appeals will do. And if they are overruled, the court of appeals will say the distinguished colleague erred. But he said with a wink, what they really meant was, you goofed, dummy. Undeterred, the National Right to Life refiled the lawsuit in the Schiavo case by claiming that their client suffers a so-called stigmatic injury. Courts have recognized such an injury when a law stigmatizes a class of people. But the law in that case, did not apply to terminally ill patients. The law applied to when they excluded black jurors simply because they were black. In the assisted suicide law, it is the patients themselves who request the help and are not singled out by others. With this, in 1997, the Death with Dignity Act, as it is now named, went into effect. But wouldn't you know this? Not giving up the cause, now is the United States Attorney General, John Ashcroft, who is leading the charge against the law. The basis for his intervention is that it violates the Controlled Substances Act. It's not funny. That requires that controlled substances be administered for a medical purpose and assisted suicide is not one. Federal Judge Robert Jones upheld the Oregon law allowing physician-assisted suicide, ruling that the Justice Department does not have the authority to overturn it. At least there is some sanity in some corners of the government. In his ruling, Judge Jones criticized Attorney General Ashcroft for seeking to nullify the state law. Judge Jones ordered the federal government to halt any efforts to prosecute Oregon physicians, pharmacists, and other health care providers who participate in assisted suicide of terminally ill patients under Oregon law. Judge Jones further stated, to allow an attorney general, an appointed executive whose tenure depends entirely on what administration occupies the White House, to determine the legitimacy of a particular medical practice without a specific congressional grant on such authority would be unprecedented. Now, Ashcroft said, we are digesting the opinion. The opinion will be evaluated in the department, and the course of action taken by the department will be determined upon our complete reading of the opinion and evaluation of circumstances. It is now generally expected that the Justice Department will appeal the ruling by Judge Jones to the 9th U.S. Court of Appeals. These are only a few examples of dealing with death where a few zealots try to impose their belief on others. Some European countries, starting with the Netherlands, have passed assisted suicide laws that are accepted by the citizens, but opposed But those opposed to it are not trying to overturn it. Our biggest fear should be that these same zealots will try to amend the U.S. Constitution like they're trying to do with same-sex marriage and the burning of the American flag. Finally, a reminder, Dacine Willman has those forms in the gallery. When I gave Davidson a copy of the text of this half of the homily, he made a number of suggestions. One was that I move a paragraph from the middle to the beginning. I thought that one was okay. Then he began making suggestions on style, and I kept telling him, no, that's not my style. If I make those changes, all I'll be doing is reading your sermon. So now you have heard the left brain of the sermon. A little later, you will hear the right brain of the sermon.
My right brain thanks you. Let's take time in the center of our service to honor some of the silences of life. We use these moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. It is Halloween, the ancient time when we allow dark spirits to mingle with the light, that we might try to integrate them. All life is tinged with death, for every day we move toward the time when we shall not move at all. And so in our prayer this morning, let us acknowledge some of the deaths in our lives, our own death, whether it is imminent or we hope more distant. How do we incorporate our death as a fact of our life? What is this life like that will end? What do we love? What do we serve? What is precious to us? What gifts do we bring? Since death must come to all, let it not stain life, but come as the inevitable ending to a life we are glad to have lived. And the death of those we love, whether impending or past, but still present in our hearts and minds, what was precious about them? What do we miss? What kind of hole do they leave in us and in the world? What sort of a gift were they to us and to others? Or the deaths of countless others, victims of wars, starvation, or disease? What has their absence robbed from the world? How much more complete would we have been had they been able to flourish and bless the world with their own unique gifts? What might be done to prevent the slaughter of war and the devastation of starvation and disease? Or more abstractly, what of the death of dreams and hope? What if your dreams have died? What hope has lost its foothold? Just name them. Sometimes we care for ourselves and our souls simply by taking our fears and losses out of the shadows, naming them and claiming them. May it happen for us here this morning, now. And so we pray. Amen. Honor some of the doubts we should entertain. Because life is bigger and more complex than we know, and I think we should leave room for ambiguity and doubt, even humility. in making life and death decisions. So, as usual, I brought you some stories. One is one I know some of you have read because you sent it to me. It was a story that appeared in the New York Times on October 5th. And the title was, On a Matter of Life or Death, a Patient is Overruled, written by a physician. And the story, very briefly, was a man, a very athletic man in his mid-50s, had severe complications after a heart attack. He was very depressed and discouraged about his future, and he had made it very clear to people, he was completely coherent, that he wanted no heroic measures and certainly no intubation, no oxygen tube stuck into his lungs. Very shortly after that, his condition degenerated to a place where he either had to be intubated or he would die. He was still coherent, and he still told the medical staff that he would have no intubation. The doctor overruled him. The medical staff forcefully overpowered him and intubated him. He had more complications. 2 weeks later, after the complications had finally cleared up, the tube was removed, the doctor came to visit him. And he told him, he was the physician who had overruled him and had ordered the tube inserted into his lungs in order to save his life. I know, said the patient, and then he added, thank you. 20 years ago, while I was writing my dissertation and working as a staff chaplain in downtown Chicago, I was part of a much more dramatic story. It was one of only two cases where it was the medical staff rather than a patient that had called for the chaplain. It was an amazing story. Mr. Robbins was 62, and he had been told recently that he was at risk for a severe stroke. On Friday night, he phoned Carol, his favorite daughter, in California for their weekly chat. And during the chat, he suddenly became very serious and said that if he ever had a massive stroke, he would absolutely not want to live for even 1 minute, and made her promise that she would honor these wishes. She agreed. The next morning, he had that stroke. He was completely paralyzed, and I was told by the medical staff that he could not speak or communicate. Carol flew to Chicago, and by the time I got to the unit on Monday afternoon, she had already ordered all life-saving measures stopped. The doctor said that time heals many things from strokes, and she really needed to wait several months before taking these drastic measures. Carol pointed out that this was the least ambiguous case they would ever find, that she had the privilege of knowing precisely what her father wanted in precisely this case, and that the information was only 3 days old. The medical staff fought her, and in fact, they snuck services to the man that she had ordered stopped. One by one, she discovered them and ordered all heroic measures stopped, including feeding him through a tube, which they had taken to doing on the night shift so she wouldn't discover it. The chief resident was nearly hysterical when she ordered the feeding stopped, saying this was nothing less than the murder of a man who would undoubtedly recover some, maybe much, of his lost faculties. But Carol had a certainty about her father's wishes that few of us will ever be able to have about anything. The discussions were very heated, and most of them took place right around the patient's bed. It was during one of these heated discussions that a nurse's aide from the night shift, who happened to be working a double shift that afternoon, spoke up. "Why don't you ask him what he wants?" she said. The doctor snarled at her and explained, in case she hadn't noticed, that he was paralyzed and incapable of communication. The nurse's aide explained that during the night shift, she'd worked out a signal system with the man, and by the twitch of a little finger, he could answer yes or no to questions. This was just electrifying. The medical staff very quickly worked up some very clever and very good test questions to make sure that the man was aware and was communicating and that his twitches weren't random. And about eight of us gathered around his bed for an amazing interview. An amazing interview. The doctors tried wisely, I think, tried to trip him up by asking trick questions to make sure he knew what was being asked. They asked whether he knew he'd had a heart attack, and he said no. They asked whether he'd had a stroke, he said yes. They asked whether he'd phoned his son, he said no. They asked whether he'd phoned his daughter Carol, he said yes. Each time, his finger wagging showed us that he was fully present and knew exactly what he was saying and what he wanted. It was very dramatic. Then they asked if he had told his daughter Carol that he would not want to live for 1 minute if he had a massive paralyzing stroke, and he said yes. Then they asked if he knew that he had, in fact, had that stroke. He said yes. They asked if he wanted to die. He said no. Because of the fluke of a nurse's aide working two shifts, who was the only one on the medical staff who had taken the trouble to try to learn how to communicate with this man, he was able to change his mind and choose the very life he had been positive a week earlier that he would not want for 1 minute. When we create fights, as we do, between a family's wishes and the advice of doctors, we run the risk that doctors may be uncaring and mechanical, and that family decisions may be caring but dangerously uninformed. In both these cases, the patients were not qualified to see the decision that they would really want made when the situation actually presented itself. Imagining the situation was not the same as being in it. They judged their future as hopeless based on an inaccurate understanding, and when their decision was overruled in the first case, or they had the chance to reverse it in the second, they were thankful to be able to do so. 40 years ago, my grandmother died. The doctors wanted to put her in a nursing home where she would receive professional medical care and said she could expect to live at least another 9 months there. She wanted to stay home and be cared for by her husband of 60 years, but they said without professional care, she would probably not live more than 3 months. I choose, she told them, to have 3 months of loving care rather than 9 months of professional care. She stayed home and died about 3 months later. I think in life we hope for more than just blind obedience by those who love us. They certainly don't give it to us when we're alive. I thought maybe I was the only one. We count on their integrity and their perception and their caring decisions, which sometimes contradict ours. And we trust those closest to us to use their judgment in caring for us. I think it's the most we can hope for in death and dying, too. My family is very small. I have just one brother. But if he were to make decisions about my life, I would want him to remember my dignity, remember what a gift life is, and remember that he loved me. And I would respect any decision that came from those memories, whether it's the decision I would have made or not. That's what you get from friends and from those who love you. And if I were charged with making the decisions for him, I would try to do it in the same way. And if my own loving and informed decisions disagreed with his,
I would forgive myself in advance, as I know he would forgive me. I hope we will have the kind of laws that Henry and almost all of you here also hope we will have. I think they're terribly important. But within those laws, I hope to receive decisions that come from an informed caring, even if they're different than the decisions I might have made. I know some of you will disagree with this. So I invite you to think about what you would hope to receive and what you would hope to give. It's Halloween, when spirits from the shadows mingle among us. For we know that the integration of both the sunny and the shadowy spirits will make us more whole and to do honor to this amazing gift of life.